Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded December 6th, 2010. Episode 45, Inside Digital Cinema. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. This week's guest geek is David Reisner, consultant to the film industry who specializes in digital cinema. Hey, David, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott, how are you today?
I'm very good, thanks. How about yourself?
I'm very well. I'm very pleased to be here.
Great, great. Those who are tuned into the live video stream at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for David, and I'll pass on as many as I can. So, David, I wanted to start with the difference between film and digital cinema. Now, your work is primarily in developing the whole industry of digital cinema and working with studios, cinematographers, and people involved in this whole thing, this whole transition from film-based cinema, which has been around for, 100 years?
Basically, yeah.
To this new format, this new paradigm of digital cinema. What can you give us in the way of a big picture overview of that transition?
Well, the first thing is, the industry sort of had to switch. The studios will save maybe $1 billion, $500 million a year in the United States alone on distribution costs with digital cinema. So it's a very strong motivation. It wasn't originally intended for specifically artistic reasons, but some of us got involved and said, hey, if we're going to do this, we have to do it correctly technically. We want to make good decisions, and we want to preserve our artistic history. The motion picture industry is, motion pictures have done amazing things for, as you said, close to 100 years, and we want to preserve that and keep the options going forward. So we did an unusual set of actual tests to try and make sure that's what we were doing. We actually, the American Society of Cinematographers, along with a studio consortium called DCI, shot a thing called the Standard Evaluation Material, STEM, feature film-like material that could be used to say, are we seeing this well enough? Are the encodings we're discussing, are the projectors we're looking at, are they good enough? Do they do the job?
We're going to get into the STEM, the Standard Evaluation Material, here in just a bit. But before we do, I wanted to sort of talk a little bit about the differences between film and digital cinema. For example, one of the biggest questions that I've always had is one of resolution. In digital cinema, we know resolution is well-defined. I think these days it's called 2K, what we normally see in the digital cinema, which is 2048 pixels this year, 2048 pixels across by 1080 pixels down.
Correct.
And next year, maybe it, or in a couple of years or whenever, it'll be 4K. We already are seeing some 4K, which is 4096 by 2160 or something like that.
Yes, exactly.
But the resolution of film has always kind of flummoxed me a little bit, because how do you define resolution on film?
Well, one of the ways to do it is to try and see what you can actually represent. So you put up test charts and you shoot them and you measure what you can see and what you can't. There's a thing called the modulation transfer function, which is basically saying when you put in black and white next to each other, do you get out black and white next to each other? Do you get out gray? And it can be characterized by frequency. And you do the tests. You shoot charts. We did one for the STEM, we'll get to, but with a very wide range of resolutions on it. The good work says that an answer print, a print made from an original camera negative, is good for about 6K lines, about 6,000 lines down the frame.
So that's
sorry,
horizontal?
6,000 across the frame. 6,000
across the frame. Okay, so 6,000 lines measured in the horizontal direction.
Yes.
From left to right.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
And so that's quite good. Now, that's from a print made from the original camera negative. Mm-hmm. When you actually get to a theater in the way things have been done historically, you've got several generations of printing that you've gone through, and you get much less. Now, a lot of people have opinions about this. They like video, and so they want film to look bad. Maybe not consciously, but in practice. So they design their tests so that film is put to a rather severe measure that's not necessarily entirely fair. And some of those tests have come out as low as 800 lines, but they're not realistic. The good numbers, people who I know whose procedures and science I trust, 6K is sort of the number that everyone has picked as being pretty much correct for 35 millimeter film. 70 millimeter or 65 would be more.
We have actually a picture of a photo micrograph of film stock versus a CCD imager, digital imager, which sort of shows us, here we go, what the difference looks like. On the left, we see the film, and I assume these little pebble-looking things are actually the film grain. Is that correct?
Yes, those are silver halide particles in a gelatin or similar suspension that are waiting for light to react to burn, as it were.
Right, and these are of different sizes. You can't really see it in this picture too well, but there's one labeled 440 nanometers, I think, and one labeled 600 and some nanometers. They're all of different sizes and all kind of jumbled together.
Yeah, and partly that's just the way the chemistry works, and partly in the modern era when companies like Kodak and Fuji, who still put a lot of effort into motion picture emulsion design, a lot of really impressive chemistry and science. Those guys do great work, both companies. I'm very impressed with them. But we don't want things to be the same size. We're happy for them to be more regular. But we don't want them to be the same. The human visual system works well with this scattered locations and scattered sizes. That's a good match for the human eye and the human brain. We see that well. Whereas the digital stuff, the square, you know, rigid stuff that doesn't move, it stays where it is, may have features between the pixels, hopefully small ones, but nonetheless, the brain and the eye pick that up in an unflattering way. It's like analog audio versus digital audio. You do digital audio well enough, it's great. But if you don't do it quite so well, the way it degrades is bad compared to the way analog degrades at the beginning. After a little while, of course, they both get terrible.
Right. So we saw on the right-hand side of that picture a digital imager, a CCD imager, I believe.
Yeah, that's correct.
And CCD, I've forgotten what that stands for. Charged coupled device, perhaps,
exactly,
right?
Exactly so.
So here we see a nice regular array of square elements, which are picking up the image. They're probably somewhat larger than the grains in the film.
Distinctly.
So film still has it over digital in terms of raw resolution, at least directly off the camera negative. As you said, by the time it gets to the theater, it's been through several generations of printing, and as a result, you're going to lose quite a bit of resolution. Do you think film at the theater end of things is roughly equal to what we can do with digital now?
No. If you're in Los Angeles or possibly New York and you're going to good theaters that are getting the best prints, or if you're in a studio review room and you see a print that was struck specifically for that purpose, then film is probably a little bit better than digital. It's not a simple comparison. They have different characteristics, but film is probably a little bit better. But if you're in a normal commercial theater, and especially if you're in some small town anywhere in the country, what you see is going to be way worse than digital. So digital in all those theaters will actually be a major upgrade. What audiences see on the screen will be much better. Our goal in digital cinema standards, what the studio's goal was, the ASC's goal, the entire community, we decided that we wanted it to be as good as answer prints. answer prints are you take the original camera negative, you do your editing, you do your basic processing, and then you make a print to look at. So that's almost as good as you can get. That was our goal. Mm. We pushed for 35 digital cinema to be close to the 35 millimeter answer print. And we were successful ultimately. It took a while. We had to hold things back for several years to get to that point. But
oh, wow. I got a great question in the chat room here. Has anyone ever experimented with image sensors of random size and arrangement?
I am not aware of any such experiment. The fabrication would be difficult and costly. If somebody wanted to fund it, I might be willing to undertake such a thing. It sounds like fun.
it's just an interesting question, I thought.
There's a number of tough elements to that problem. I think it would be fascinating to know what the result was, but I doubt that we're going to find out.
Anytime soon, yeah.
Yeah, not until we have nanotech. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Nanotechnology is when that might happen. What about colorimetry? The color gamut, the range of colors that can be represented. How is that different between film and digital cinema?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is the film is colorimetry is due to the chemistry of the emulsions, and so it's not a simple even thing. Most of your viewers have probably seen these triangles. They're published in the magazine Your Reviews all the time.
Right, we have one up. We have one we can display here called CIE. I think it's called CIE something or another, John.
The file name, I'll let you guys figure out. What it is, what we'll see is the standard horseshoe illustration of the CIE 1931 2-degree standard observer. In 1931, the CIE did these fairly extensive tests to try and characterize human vision, and they came up with a description of a standard observer, a typical, good typical observer. Mm-hmm. Some people are better, some are worse.
This was the result of a test of a bunch of people and kind of averaging their response to color, right?
That is correct, yes. And there's some interesting things in that. It's actually another hard thing to do. But if you take some of the best people in this industry, the colorists like Lou Levinson, who are, you know, fantastically good and very name brand, they know how they see things with their left eye and their right eye. They can see the color difference between their own two eyes. So as you might expect, between people, there's distinct differences in color perception. But we try and keep it within a sort of a range. And we've done, and we, meaning the ASC Technology Committee Advanced Imaging Subcommittee, which I help run, we've done tests within the last 2 years to see that the CIE 1931 is still doing a decent job for motion pictures as we present them today, and that's working out. That worked out okay. It looks like it's actually decent, even though we know there are some specific problems with it. They're not a problem for us. By the way, those tests were conceived of by Gary Demos, who is the chair of that subcommittee and a fantastic guy. Look up his Academy Award history, and you'll be impressed.
Okay. All right. So if we can look at that picture again, we will see if we can. It may be a little difficult to see on this feed.
Yeah, I was noticing.
The triangles. There are several triangles within that horseshoe.
Let me identify what those are, and I'll give you a rough idea. The red triangle on the outside is what's called XYZ. That's the CIE thing that's intended to contain in all of human vision, everything people can see. And that's the encoding that we use in digital cinema for what we send to the theaters. We send to the theaters XYZ. So anything inside that red triangle, we can send to the theater.
Now wait a second. Hang on a second now. I was under the impression that the entire range of human vision was within the horseshoe. And yet that red triangle extends outside of the horseshoe.
Right. That's for technical mathematical reasons that we can get into if you like. But
No, that's okay. I mean, we are geeks here. We are all geeks on this bus after all, but we don't need to get into the math. Give me the short version, yeah.
We use three numbers to encode colors, and the three numbers are the corners of that triangle. So we want the triangle to enclose the entire horseshoe. We don't want to have to use more numbers than that. We make it simple. We waste a little space by using something bigger than we strictly need.
I see. Okay. All right. Now, so I am correct that horseshoe is the entirety of what humans can see in terms of color.
That is correct. And then some. Yeah.
And then some.
Right? Well, no, sorry. The horseshoe is the entire, yes, the triangle right. is and then some.
Yeah, the triangle is then some. And that's what you use mathematically to encode whatever's inside the triangle.
Exactly. Exactly okay. correct. Yes.
I mean, whatever's now, inside the horseshoe is what I meant.
Right. To encode the color you want to see.
Right.
Now, on that triangle drawing, there are several other triangles inside it. The smallest one is NTSC, the modern version of NTSC, the old version of NTSC. No one ever built, and it was, but it was a little better. That's the yellow one. The green one is what's called REC 709 or BTU 709. That's high definition television. A properly made, properly set up high definition television can do that green triangle. Then outside that is the blue triangle. That's the what's called the D-cinema, digital cinema, reference projector, minimum gamut. So if something is going to be a legitimate digital cinema projector, it has to at least do that blue triangle. And in practice, that's all they all do. No, nobody does more than that blue triangle. Maybe someday, hopefully someday with laser light sources, we'll use more of the color space. I know people who have seen experimental units. They've described it as colors that they haven't seen since college. probably with chemical assistance.
Yes, indeed.
But someday we may see those in our theaters. If laser light engines are our best bet on that, but no one's there yet.
Right.
And it gets complicated if some projectors do one set of colors and some projectors do another set of colors. It makes it hard for the studios to figure out what to send to the theaters. Studios right, so love it when they can send one thing.
Of course. And we in the consumer electronics industry want to make sure that TVs reproduce the same set of colors, one TV to the next, as much as possible.
Very important.
Because, yeah, very important because the content is being created with a certain set of colors in mind. And so if the TV reproduces a different set of colors, then when the signal says do green, then that green will look different if yeah. it's not, if the TV isn't correct. So I assume the same thing applies to film camera, film projectors and digital projectors both.
Yes, but with film projectors, it's relatively simple. You want your light source to be the same, the correct color of white, and you want the reflector to have the correct filtering on it to make the white point color temperature be the correct thing. And sometimes they're not, and things age, and you have to update theaters periodically and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But within that, the color is determined by the film emulsion. In digital, you don't have that kind of photochemical reference, so you have to measure things to make sure that they're correct. And that's true in the theater, and that's one of the benefits we're getting by the digital cinema conversion is that a lot of theaters are being set up fresh and measured fresh, and the screens are being cleaned, and all sorts of new stuff. Everything's being tuned up, the audio too. But at home, we have a real problem. First off, manufacturers typically do not ship their televisions set up to display correctly in that way. It's because it doesn't sell well on the showroom floor.
People exactly right.
Like bright and blue. Then people fiddle with their TVs. They're watching them in difficult viewing environments. There's a thing called color appearance modeling. It's a science that is relatively recent. And it says what you're looking at, how you perceive what you see, depends on the environment you're seeing it in.
Mm-hmm.
But that makes you, we all know this, right? You turn on the lights in your living room, you see one thing on the TV, you turn off the lights in the living room, you see something else. If you have a home theater, you know, you might have fist fights with your friends about how much light to have or not have when you're looking at movies.
Right.
All these things affect the way people perceive the motion pictures.
Right.
So we have to... We try and deal with those things. In the cinema, we have standards. We say, make the projector be 14-foot Lamberts. Perhaps some theater does do that. Perhaps some theater doesn't. Maybe they want to save the lamp life a little bit, or maybe they just haven't been checked out recently. Mm-hmm. But 14-foot Lamberts is the reference. We have a number of other statistics, if you will, that can be measured and can be set up. And digital is good at that. It's easier in many ways to set up digital than to set up film if you have the required test equipment and the required knowledge. So
very good. I got one question in the chat room. Beatmasters asked asking about extended RGB and the problem about it. I'm not sure I understand that question entirely. Do you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very good question. Well, I can think of an interpretation of it, at least, that's a very good question.
Okay. Go for it.
Okay, we have filmmakers, cinematographers, directors, colorists, the producers, the whole set of people, the whole big team make something to look a particular way. They want a movie to look a particular way. Think of, I don't know, Road to Perdition, let's say, because it's got a very wide range from darks to lights. They wanted that to look a specific way. Especially think about the shootout in the alley towards the end, the apartment and then the alley. The way that they wanted that to look has a lot to do with the feel of the story. It creates what the piece of art, it creates the story. Now, people get that in their home and they say, oh, well, my room is more brightly lit or it's not what I favor. I like it when things look different. And they fiddle with their TV setup to make things look different. Some TVs have greater than, well, nobody has the P3 primaries in their televisions. Some manufacturers are working in that direction.
But the P3 primaries, by the way, are the DCI primaries, or that largest, I think, blue triangle in the CIE chart, right?
Exactly correct. Exactly correct. So that's what a minimum digital cinema reference projector does.
And no TVs can do that yet, or very few.
Right. It's probably very few as opposed to none, but at the consumer level, a couple of TVs get close. Most TVs do a fantastic job on 709. They do HDTV correctly the way HDTV is supposed to be done. It wouldn't be of any use to do P3 in a normal consumer television with a HDTV or HD signal. If you had a Blu-ray disc and you played it, there's no method on a Blu-ray disc to encode the P3 color triangle. It's not there.
Right. Right. So now, because it's not there, the TV has no need to be able to reproduce it.
Right, unless they also want to be used in professional circumstances or in, you know, prosumer, people who are using Final Cut or something to make movies at home and who are aiming towards the theater, which is a great thing as far as I'm concerned. But the extended color space stuff, a lot of manufacturers make their TVs do a bit more because they feel that will help them sell. And they include processing to take an image, guys playing football, to make the grass look greener than it actually is in the signal that that people received at home. And perhaps the viewer enjoys having the grass look greener. But for a motion picture, like Road to Perdition, let's say, you want the things that you see on that screen to look the way the director and the cinematographer intended, not to look some expanded way that's, hey, it's fun, but it's this weird thing that's not what was originally created. So you want to see the artwork the way the artwork was intended. That's my position. And of course, if somebody wants to see something wildly different, you know what? It's their money, it's their eyes, it's their life experience. You know, they get to do it. And in the industry side of things, we may be unhappy about it, but that's just the way it goes.
Yeah. No, I agree with you completely, and I rail about this all the time, that I want to see what the director, the content producer, intended.
Yeah, these guys are artists. I mean, really, not even though it's art created with technology, it is honest to gosh art, and it's art that we all enjoy quite a bit, or much of the time. It's amazing how good a job these people do overall. I mean, I couldn't do it. I can design this stuff, but I couldn't make movies.
Right, exactly right. GeoMeek asks, why stop at the theater? Just drive the bits home. My answer to that would be, because unless you're super rich, you're not going to get nearly as large a picture as you are in the theater. What do you think?
Well, people don't have viewing environments in their homes. Even most home theaters, most good home theaters, don't do what a cinema does. The screens are different. The amount of light in the room varies quite a bit. Different than the theater, though theaters are not always ideal either, frequently not ideal. The color space that a home cinema projector can do is quite different. It's that smaller triangle, the green one inside the blue one. So there's colors you won't see. There's no method for right now for getting those bits home. Now, if we could get the what's called the DCDM, the Digital Cinema Distribution Master, to the home. And if we had a way of dealing with the security of doing that, which we do not, but if we did, and if people could afford, say, $125,000 for a projector and maybe $30,000 for their screen, you know, then you could have a digital cinema in your home. It would be fantastic. I would love to. I wanted a 35-millimeter screening room for decades, and it wasn't until I became a full-out adult and had to pay all my own bills and had a family to take care of that I realized, you know what? I'm not going to have a screening room. I would like to, but it's just not going to happen.
Right, right. Well, you get access to probably a wide variety of screening rooms as it is in your job, so it may not be as critical.
Well, I don't get to watch what I want when I want most of the time. I mean, occasionally there's somebody I can call up and I can say, could you show me this? And if this is a correctly chosen thing for their timing, what projects they're working on, maybe. Mm-hmm. But mostly I don't get to see the gorgeous stuff that I would love to see. And some of that's fair. You know, Universal is not going to open up their vault for me. If nothing else, they want to keep their prints that are in the vault in better shape than my messing around with them. Maybe I would treat them well, but they don't want to take a chance. That's smart. We all appreciate that.
Sure. One more thing about this difference or the transition from film to digital, and that is the production process. We have a little diagram here that shows the production process that you were kind enough to provide called Production to Screen. And if we take a look at that, we can see sort of the difference between the two production paths and how they, in fact, can overlap or cross over one to the other. Why don't you describe a little bit about what's going on here?
Happily. And this is an interesting slide historically for a couple of reasons. At the top, we have the old way things were done photochemically. A camera shoots film. There's what's called photochemical intermediate. You take the film and you run it through baths of water with chemicals in it and do optical printing to fiddle with things. And then when you're done, you make a print, you stick it in a truck, and you put it out to the theater on a projector. Then a few years ago, we were doing that some, but we were starting to do what's called digital intermediate, where instead of the chemical bath stuff, we encode things digitally and we manipulate it with computers. In that case, we did a scan. That's what the data cine is there for. You've heard of perhaps telecine. That's a lower quality thing. Data cine is for serious cinema. And you'd scan the film and turn it into bits. You fiddle with it in digital intermediate. When you have everything the way you like, you put it back through the film recorder, you put it in the UPS truck or whichever, but UPS has a lot of them, and you take them to the theaters and you show the film. But now we've changed faster than anybody ever anticipated. I was the most aggressive person in my predictions of schedule, and I was slow. But we shoot now with digital cameras. I would say more than half of movies are shot with digital cameras, and we're going to see that pick up a lot in the next 2 years, let's say.
I'm astonished that we're already over 50%. I had no idea about that. When you told me that the other day, I was floored.
That's what I'm told by the people at the studios. I'm not at a rental place. I don't have those. I'm not writing the checks, so I can't tell you for sure. But what people are telling me is that we're at more than 50%. Yeah.
Wow.
So in that case, you shoot digitally. You take the data straight into digital intermediate. You do the stuff you're going to do with it. And if you're doing a digital distribution, you ultimately send it straight out send the bits out to the digital projector in the theater. So it's a nice.
Now, is that done by some sort of satellite transmission, or do you actually deliver a hard disk, or how does that work?
A lot of people wanted it to be satellite, and someday it may be satellite. But satellite is not convenient or economical until you have a large enough footprint of theaters. If you think about the spot that a satellite covers, right, in that splash on the ground that it's transmitting to, you need to have a bunch of theaters to amortize the cost. So the way it's done currently is hard drive, USB or FireWire, I think they're typically USB, hard drives. You just to get shipped by UPS.
UPS is still in business distributing movies. It's just little hard drives instead of big reels of film.
Right, and those hard drives are being produced predominantly by Technicolor and Deluxe, the same companies that were doing the film prints. There's various reasons for that. Part of them is that they're good companies. They do good work. Part of it is that the studios are comfortable with Technicolor and Deluxe. They've have long-term relationships with them. They're confident that they're going to do what needs to be done. If some guy comes in, I've worked for clients who wanted to do that, and it's difficult for the studios to be comfortable that this new company is going to do the right thing. You know, making a movie is expensive. There's a lot you don't get, and you don't get to make an arbitrary number of movies. And then once you have the movies, getting them into the theaters is difficult. There's a lot of competition for that screen time most of the time, most of the good screen time, not Tuesday morning, but Friday evening, you know, a lot of competition. And so people, movie studios, larger studios, smaller studios, they want their project to get the best handling possible because they're not going to get to do an arbitrary number of those projects. It's a big deal.
Yeah, yeah. One other difference that I wanted to ask you about between the two has to do with the black level. I don't actually know what the average or general difference is between black levels that you can get with film and black levels that you can get with digital. What's your understanding of that?
Well, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, so I'm not going to try and quote numbers. But in both cases, a major factor is the amount of light that there is in the theater and the reflectiveness of the walls, seats, carpets in the theater. So if the theater and the exit signs, you know, that are required by law, if the theater was pitch black, we would see better blacks with both film and digital. I would say that modern print stocks, you know, Vision 2 or newer, have a bit better blacks than the current batch of digital cinema projectors. But if it turns out I'm wrong, I'm not completely shocked. I'm not right up to date on that, but that's the way it's tended to be. But neither one of them matters because the light, the brightness in the theater, the amount of stray light, lifts that lowest level up some.
It'll wash out that difference.
But or pretty close. We don't have an opportunity to push down as much as we want. Now, we kind of held up rolling out digital cinema until the digital cinema projectors could do an 1800:1 contrast ratio for sequential.
That's a full white screen versus a full black screen.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's as opposed to ANSI contrast, which is the white and black checkerboard.
Right.
Where, if I'm not mistaken, a good ANSI contrast ratio in a theater is something like 200:1.
It's going to have to be a little bit high. Digital cinema standards require 400:1.
Oh.
Now, that's going to be manufacturer's equipment. It doesn't mean that installed in the theater, that's what happens. But we knew that it mattered, and we pushed. Now let me toss. Let me just. Whoops, I may be misquoting. I got some other numbers here. Okay, I take it all back. I apologize to everyone. We tried for 400:1, and it wasn't reasonable. We ended up standardizing a minimum of 150 for review rooms and 100 for theaters. Scott's number is probably correct for what you're actually seeing.
Okay, and you might want you. It'd probably be better if you didn't go online and look up stuff online while you're on Skype.
Yeah, sorry about that. For numbers, I had to look down and check.
Okay, very good. So I'm glad you did, though. Even with a little problem in the audio for that moment, because I did remember more correctly that, in fact, you're looking for 150:1, which doesn't seem like a lot. But again, we're talking this black and white checkerboard contrast, which is always going to be a lot lower than what's called sequential contrast, or a full white field followed by a full black field. Measure those, and you'll get a much higher number.
Right. Effects in the lens, and also the amount of light that's in the room that's splashing around and going back onto the screen.
Right. Exactly. Beatmaster in the chat room asks, is the competition between VC1 and H.264 still running? What's going on with encoding in digital cinema? Is there a standard or not?
Oh, absolutely. In digital cinema, we locked it down at JPEG 2000. So we're not looking at VC1 or H.264. Those are consumer, and I suppose that if either one of those systems became good enough or somebody came out with an H.265, as it were, that was meaningfully better, possibly it would get used in post-production. It's something would have to be damn good, but it's conceivable. Mm-hmm. But digital cinema is locked at JPEG 2000. We said we want one thing that we know what it is, we know what it does, we don't want it to change, and we want systems to be able to support it without being constantly updated. We mm-hmm. want reliability is high on our list for digital cinema.
You bet. the other two things come to mind about why I personally prefer going to digital cinema. One is, once you start looking at film and you notice this, you can't get away from it. I can't anyway, which is what's called a gate judder. Okay, so this film, uh-huh. this physical piece of film is being pulled through the projector and stopping at each frame in the gate. And this motion causes the image to jitter or judder just a little bit. And with digital, of course, that it doesn't happen at all. The image is rock solid. The other thing, well, there's three things. That's one. Two is unless the print is pristine and you're only looking at it the first few times it goes through the projector, you're going to see little scratches and dirt and stuff like that. I mean, I see that all the time when I go to film. And the third thing, reel change markers. Every 20 minutes or so, you get this little black blip up in the upper right corner of the screen to tell the projectionist about time to change reels. And again, once you start seeing that, you can't not see it. It just bugs the hell out of me.
Well, some of us like what they're called cigarette burns, because that's how they used to be made.
Really?
Some of us, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that was the reel change marker, was a cigarette burn?
Yes, absolutely.
That's absolutely incredible.
And they were done very much by hand. But some of us like that because we like the film history, where we like film, even when we recognize that digital is giving us some very good things and that maybe we'd rather watch digital. I mentioned earlier this modulation transfer function thing. With digital, the modulation transfer function graph goes all the way out to the highest frequency that's handled, and then it just drops straight down like a brick wall. Mm-hmm. With film, it kind of falls off. The same thing is true, let's say, of a CRT display versus a plasma display. Traditionally, when making movies, people, they have a lot of nostalgia, let's say, for CRTs. They wouldn't call it nostalgia, I would. They like the way CRTs look, and they do have some good characteristics. But I think good plasma is a much better screen. Or now there are some professional LCDs. Dolby has just released one that also looks like they do very good things. Maybe better than plasmas, possibly, but at least very good things in any event. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I like that look. I like to see the detail. I like to have the abrupt contrast changes available. You know, I think those things look good. I respond well to them. Mm-hmm. I like my fixed pixel imager television better than I like my quite good CRT rear projector. You know, I got a good CRT rear projection set, but I like the fixed pixel stuff better. I'm about to go for a new 50 or 60 inch as a holding action until I can install the projection screen. That's, we got a baby, and so the projection screen's on hold for a little while.
Congratulations on the baby, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much. He's a fantastic kid. I would bend everyone's ear about him, but I'll hold my peace.
Well, we only have limited time here, and I know that you'd probably take the rest of the time up talking about how great the kid is.
Could happen.
Good. Okay. I want to make sure we get some time on the STEM, the standard evaluation material, and also a related set of images called the camera assessment series, which you have used to evaluate how different digital cameras perform. Am I correct?
Yes, exactly. And that's has had two two important functions. I'll do STEM and then I'll do camera assessment series quickly on each.
Great.
For STEM, the American Society of Cinematographers, the ASC, these are the guys that shoot the best pictures, or shoot pictures the best, let's say. They're really good. And they've been doing this for 85 or 100 years. They were formed to help the industry understand the technology and understand the processes and make their movies better. And they're still doing that. They're great. The ASC formed a technology committee a couple years back, handful or so. I'm the secretary of that ASC technology committee, the first time in the ASC's history that somebody who's not an ASC cinematographer has even been on an ASC committee. So it's my little bit of motion picture history. When DCI was doing the specifications, the requirements documents, really, for digital cinema, there were a bunch of us that said, we want this to do what feature films need. And DCI eventually, fairly quickly, said, okay, how do we figure this out? And we shot this thing called the STEM, the Standard Evaluation Material, to be representative of what feature films do. It's a little bit stressful. It has a little bit of challenge to it. But basically, it's to be as good as a feature film and to look like a feature film, but to be available for everyone to use. No actors that have to sign releases and studios that have to be convinced that their stuff won't get stolen and pirated. So it's a short movie, 12 minutes, I think, that can be was used by people making projectors or evaluating projectors and making all the other stuff in post-production to see, is this good enough? And we did that with some, DCI also did some serious testing of psychoacoustic stuff, psychovisual stuff. Mm-hmm. And those things together were what we used to say, what do we need to be good enough? How many bits do we need for the encoding for digital cinema, that kind of thing. So it was very hands-on in addition to a good theoretical and engineering basis. So that was very pleasing.
We have some images from that. The one I want to show first is called Title Sky Confetti, which I've actually seen the STEM in a digital cinema, and it is somewhat challenging and very interesting in that it exercises different aspects of the filmmaker's art. Here's a Digital Sky Confetti, and what's interesting about this is the big expanse of solid blue sky with these tiny little pieces of confetti floating down. This is only a still image, but this provides, if I'm not mistaken, a real challenge for the encoder to get what looks almost like noise, that little tiny confetti, to encode that properly.
Exactly correct, Scott. And if you see it in a theater and you look carefully enough, you can see differences in the reproduction of the confetti at different times at different situations. But that's challenging. Anyone who knows encoders at all, and most of your viewers probably do because they use them all the time on their Blu-ray discs, will know that that's very challenging. And it's even more challenging for a Blu-ray type encoder than it is, which is typically a discrete cosine transform, than it is for a JPEG 2000 encoder, which is a wavelet transform. It's a difference in the way the mathematics are handled. But the blue sky is also challenging because both in encoding and mastering and in projection, if you don't get that blue pretty even, you see differences. You could see banding. You could see slight differences in the shades of blue. If you don't have enough bits in the image, you might notice, it's darker blue here, and then there's kind of a line, and then it's just a teeny bit lighter. But I see that line. So it was challenging in that way as well. The person we can thank for that and a lot of the things in STEM, Howard Luck, who was the chief engineer at DCI, and then it was at Disney, and now at Disney. He was responsible for a lot of that stuff. Howard and I, put our heads together for a lot of that stuff, and as did the whole subcommittee, a bunch of people involved in doing this. But if you had to pick a leader on the tech side, I would say Howard.
Another image we have is Wedding Walk Day, which I think shows more or less a daytime, brightly lit scene. The scene is the image of a wedding, and here it is. What are the challenging items in this scene?
Well, the gowns worn by the bride and the bridesmaids are slightly different shades. And the one on the left is yellow. You can see probably even on this reproduction that it's fairly yellow. But sometimes that goes missing when something's not set up correctly. The lace on the bride's veil and dress and the lace on the other bridesmaid's dress be very difficult to produce. This particular shot doesn't show it, but just before it and very shortly after, there are things to stress the motion. So these people are walking. They walk past a fence. Walking past a fence is a good way to be mean to motion stuff. There's also some laundry back there that we're not seeing in that particular shot, but it's very close by in the scene. It's just to the upper left. And making out the lines on that laundry, the stripes on the nightshirt, that kind of thing, very challenging. And in general, they get lost. Usually, they're not seen. Also, the street signs. It's full of all sorts of small stuff. Also, skin tones. That's a very, yes, very important thing for cinema to produce well, is a variety of skin tones.
Yes.
And in that specific scene, it's a medium variety. But in other parts of STEM, we have a wider variety as well. And, you know, you would notice if you went to a movie and people's skin looked funny. You would care.
Yeah,
so
sure.
You had to get that right.
Now, is STEM, I know STEM is not currently available to consumers. Is there any plan to make it available so people can use it to evaluate the quality of their own display at home?
Well, I'm going to get myself in trouble a little bit here, and I'm going to tell people to make phone calls or send emails to DCI. That's DCIMovies.com. DCI has the ultimate legal control of the STEM stuff, and it was intended to be generally available for people to use, mostly for businesses, but conceivably people in the home. And Joe Kane has done a very serious mastering of STEM onto Blu-ray. And of course, on a Blu-ray for STEM or for the camera assessment series, which he's done as well, you don't see everything you see in the theater. You just don't. It's not there.
Right.
The encodings can't do it. The colors aren't there. The bit depth isn't there. But you can still see useful things. They're still interesting. And Joe had Lou Levinson, who was the colorist for STEM, and Alan Davio, who was the cinematographer for STEM. He had them work with him doing this, the STEM master. So he's got, I haven't seen it myself because he's not even allowed to show it to me, but he's got a very good STEM master. DCI is not currently letting him distribute that because he would be doing it technically for profit. In practice, he'd probably at best break even.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it would be okay. I think the ASC would probably think it was okay for DCI to allow Joe Kane to make this available to people for non-commercial use.
Right.
But it's not right now. Now, the camera assessment series, Joe Kane's version of that, is available. So if people want to see what the camera assessment series looks like, that can be bought. I think the name is something like DVD International. It's
that's Joe Kane's distributor. Yes, for his products. Absolutely.
Yeah. So you can get the camera assessment series Blu-ray there. Now the camera assessment series, right, the STEM was for projection and exhibition distribution. The camera assessment series is for the cameras. You're shooting movies. It's at the other end of the chain, the beginning.
Right.
And we wanted to know, how are these different digital cameras behaving? There are a number of digital cameras that are trying to be or claim to be cinema ready, and we wanted to run them through their paces so that ASC cinematographers and others, but especially ASC cinematographers, could look at the behavior of each camera and say, how will this work for the show that I want to do, for the project I'm doing? You know, maybe we would argue that certain cameras are better than other cameras kind of across the board, but it's not really the issue. The issue is you're trying to shoot a particular movie. You've got a particular show you want to do. You want the right camera for that show, you know, and sometimes it'll be one and sometimes it'll be another. But that's really something cinematographers care about a lot. Now, STEM was important in showing that. It also helped us understand some important things about the post-production chain that we're still working on doing better. We've got some new stuff coming down the line from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, a thing called IIF. It's a big deal. It's important.
By the way, that stands for Image Interchange Framework.
That's correct. And it's a way of trying to be have everyone do things so that everyone can know what everyone's doing. It's one of the big problems. And have the things that are doing be capable. Have wide color space. Be you can do math without screwing it up. That kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's a good piece of work. A lot of good people have been putting in a lot of time and effort on that from all across the industry. And universities, very wide range.
Now you said, I think you told me earlier that there are three features currently in post using IIF as a test project.
That is what I am told. And there have been rooms that I have wanted to go into and not been able to go to schedule because they were being used for that purpose. So I have reason to believe that it is in fact happening. What the features are, I would love to know myself, and I certainly look forward to seeing them. I'm sure I'll see them before you guys do by a little bit, but I would love to see what's going on right now. But it's still a very experimental project, even though it's being done with commercial releases. And so they're playing it close to the chest. They don't want, you know, and so that's what's going on right now. But so for the camera assessment series, one of the very important things that we found is that a number of these digital cameras for a number of purposes work pretty well. You know, they're doing pretty good jobs. We didn't necessarily expect that. A lot of cinematographers certainly did not expect that. And so one of the effects has been that a number of cinematographers have seen digital footage, digital camera footage, that they and film footage of the same stuff that they've been able to really dig at and look at carefully and say, you know what? I could use this for my project if I want to, and there may be some reasons to want to. So it's sort of an unintended consequence, but not a bad thing, just we didn't anticipate it. Probably it's increasing the speed of shifting to shooting with digital cameras predominantly.
You said earlier that it was, you know, over 50% now, and maybe the camera assessment series might have helped accelerate that.
Yes, absolutely. I know that, for example, Arri, a camera manufacturer, they make great cameras, fantastic film cameras, some excellent digital cameras as well. If you wanted to buy an Arri Super 16 camera, 16mm film, you could get one at a good price right now, I think. They're great cameras, but people aren't using them. When people would be doing that, instead they're shooting digital now.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the case 12 months ago. Certainly not 24, but it wasn't even 12.
Incredible.
Now, you still have to be careful when you're doing projects with digital. You know, there are better and worse cameras, and there are cameras that are more and less appropriate for a project. And there are some cameras that people are enthusiastic and excited about, which are not appropriate or suitable for every project. But people that are enthusiastic or excited use them for every project. If you look carefully at Social Network, right, a great movie. I think it could win Best Picture, and I wouldn't be upset if it did. I think David Fincher is a great filmmaker. I really like his work. But that was shot with a digital camera, and maybe I wouldn't have shot it with that digital camera in quite that way. At least I would have used a bigger lighting package. Now, it came out, it tells the story great, but let's say there's some extra processing and hand-holding that went in there to make it look on the screen in the theater the way David wanted it to look, you know, and it's his vision on the screen, okay? I got no doubt at all. He's a great filmmaker, and he takes really serious pains with his movies, and he has a great team. But I think that if they had used a different camera, or if they'd used more lighting by a bit, that they could have made their job in post-production a little bit easier.
Mm.
And that said, I think it's a great picture.
Well, I haven't seen it yet, but I sure look forward to it, especially after that recommendation. We're just about out of time, and I'm really sorry about that because we didn't even get to 3D. We've got more to talk about, so I hope you'll come back and join us.
I would be pleased to do so. We're trying to do with 3D what we did with the 2D stem to let people see what's going on. That's a project that's just in the offing.
Yeah, we'll talk about that one then next time. I do want to draw people's attention to one thing. In the show notes for this show, I have included, in addition to David's bio, a piece that he wrote with a list of test scenes from common, well-known movies, Road to Perdition, Harry Potter 2, The Godfather, Apocalypse Now, and so on, that illustrate different challenges for all display systems. And so I encourage you to go check that out when it's posted, when this podcast gets posted on twit.tv/HTG. And for this show, there will be that extra little piece of information in the show notes, which I really appreciate. And I think everyone's going to really find very valuable. So thanks again, David, for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Good. You can read about David's work at his website, d-cinema.us. My online homes, of course, are ultimateavmag.com and hometheatermag.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv and follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Kevin Wines, the image technology director at THX, talking about THX certification of 2D and 3D displays. So that should be very interesting. Until then, geek out.